Hey, y'all. How's it going? Welcome to the show. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. Come here, you. All right, it's the show. Greg Palast is going to be here today. I haven't talked to him in since forever, man. You know what happened? I didn't finish his book, so I couldn't interview him about it. So then I never talked to him after that. I'm really bad about that. I really gotta make some time. I gotta stop sleeping. So if I could just spend all night reading books and then all day doing all the other things I have to do all day, then that'd be great. Fortunately, I have to lay down and rest like an animal or something. It's ridiculous. Anyway, try to get Greg's book read eventually someday. Anyway, he's going to be on the show because I know he knows all about Venezuela. And yeah, it's true that he's sort of one of these good government Democrat types. But he hates the Democrats because they're evil, like the Republicans. He's a good investigative reporter. You know, Greg Palast, the way he became an investigative reporter was his job was investigating the state utilities in California. Right, the electric companies and all that stuff. His job was investigating them for the state legislature. And then he decided what he was good at was investigating public utilities. Mm-hmm. So he's got real skills that he brings to bear on his journalism, and I like him. So good old Greg will be on the show to tell us all about the probably, right, must be U.S.-backed putsch in Venezuela right now. And then Eric Margolies will be on to talk about the U.S. back putsch. I don't know how to say it right. In Ukraine right now. And then, I don't know, I guess I could ask him about Thailand because Eric knows everything about everything. And ask him all about who's coup and who down there in Thailand this week. Most importantly, for Eric Margolies, all about Ukraine. Picking a fight with the Russians. I guess the big news in from Ukraine is that they have some kind of deal, sorta. They've come up with a deal where the president is going to give up some of his powers to the prime minister, and they're going to give the prime minister's spot to the opposition, and they're going to hold early elections. That sounds pretty concessionary on the part of the democratically elected dictator there. I can't, again, shoe other foot. Imagine an American president of either party ever under any circumstances giving in to early elections, giving in to, even early House elections, right? Imagine a president who has a majority of his same party in the House, George Bush with a majority Republican Party, House of Representatives, or Obama with the Democrats. But there's such a controversy over, I don't know, Obamacare or war with Syria or something, that the opposition demand is that the Democrats have to give up the House speakership. That's part of their compromise. Not because the Republicans have the majority of the votes in the House anymore, but just because we say so. These are the new rules, or else we'll occupy all of D.C., shut down everything, burn down Democratic National Committee headquarters. Yeah. If that happened under Bush, George Bush would send the police and or, if necessary, the military out to win. That'd be the end of that. If it was Barack Obama, the exact same thing. Give us a break. But over here in Ukraine, all right, he's got 100 compromises he's willing to give up. I'm not on the side of Yushchenko, really, but it's pretty hard to be on the side of the CIA in this one, isn't it? Anyway, Eric Margolies will be on the show to talk about the Democrats' dirty tricks there in Ukraine. I'm interested in what Palast is going to have to say about Venezuela, too. That's another one of those cases where I hate all governments in the world, and I'm pretty sure if I lived in Ukraine, I would hate that government, and I'm fairly certain if I lived in Venezuela, I would hate that one too. But I hate my government choosing their governments more than I think I would hate their governments if I lived there. If you understand my position. It's true. One can have an opinion that does not necessarily and immediately translate into, therefore, the federal government ought to kill anyone who opposes my will. I know that that's surprising. I know most people think an opinion is something you think the national government ought to do to somebody. But I have a conflicting opinion, which is that there should not be a national government in the U.S. In fact, I don't even think the U.S. should be the U.S. I want the U.S. out of America right now. I want a free market, private property anarchy between Canada and Mexico and everywhere else too. So I hardly want to hand them a mandate to change regimes in foreign lands. And particularly not when it means picking a fight with the Russians. Boy, you know, there's a rogue state the Americans just can't get over. And it's not that they're a rogue state out in the world acting like Americans or anything. It's just that Vladimir Putin's government maintains independence from the American Empire. Which, you know what, even if you don't like that, still tough, right? What are you going to do about it? You going to do something about it? It's Russia. It's like a third of the landmass of the earth or something. A quarter of it or a fifth. And lots and lots and lots, by which I mean thousands of hydrogen bombs on three-stage intercontinental ballistic missiles. So therefore, you just can't do anything about it, no matter what your opinion of what's going on in Russia is, or what your opinion is of their defiance of the American Empire. Still, just tough. And, you know, for all the fear-mongering, it seems like they had a lot better case back when there was still such a thing as the USSR. But since the Russian Federation is a tiny, pathetic rump of what the Soviet Union had been, I think, there's all the demonization has sort of fallen flat. And what was the smart thing I read this morning? Saying all this about Russia's just mad because they won't go along with us on Syria. Probably has a lot to do with it. I think I read an essay like that this morning, didn't I? Yeah. Anyway. Yeah. Well, so there you go. That's what's coming up on the show. Me complaining, plus talking questions at Greg Palast and Eric Marley's and their responses. Okay. Now, the first thing I have to say is the dumbest thing I have to say on the show today, but this is the kind of crap that everybody likes listening to, you know, popular current events, who said something that got them in trouble for saying it. What a controversy. So in this case, the Nuge, you know, the guitar player, he said a thing that people don't like. Well, I know what guitar players say usually carries a lot of weight, but in this case, it's a hell of a lot of weight. Because, of course, Ted Nugent, he's a pro-gun guy, and he's a militarist, sort of a right-winging, sort of a political dude out there. I credit him with completely abolishing the slightest idea I ever had of gun control being a good idea when I was in ninth grade and heard him on the radio one time. I was 14. I was 14 past there. I thought everybody thought that there were too many guns, something, but I thought it was a consensus. Then I heard Ted Nugent completely destroyed the idiocy of gun control. God, how do you... Anyway, good old him. He's terrible on everything else. But anyway, so he calls Obama a subhuman mongrel. And it's a controversy because he's helping the Republican here in Texas run for governor. And so everybody's saying, oh, you have to disavow what this guy said and this and that. So here's my only point I'm trying to make about that, if I got a point about it. The first thing is, really a mongrel? That's what's wrong with Barack Obama, is that he's mixed race? Is that what you're talking about? Are you kidding me? Seriously? In the 21st century, you think that? What an idiot. Oh, yeah, you know. Interracial dating is just really bothering Ted Nugent in 2014. And then, that's not it. Here's what is important here, is of course Obama is subhuman. He's a president. He's a mass murderer. He's the most terrible person on the face of the planet. If there's anyone who's given up their right to life and liberty, it's him. He's the devil. Not because of who, his father's skin color. What? And by the way, yes, he should be tried and convicted. And I think he should just do life and die of natural causes in the Supermax, for the record. Hey, y'all, Scott here. So you made a little bit of money in this horrid economy, only to find that the Fed has more or less outlawed saving. So into the treacherous waters of the stock market bubble you go. But how to make a little money without too much risk of losing it all? Check out WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson is a successful former hedge fund manager who opens a very real window into his main account, updating his subscribers on the facts of and the reasoning behind all his market moves. Follow along on paper or with real money and see what happens at WallStreetWindow.com. Don't worry about things you can't control. Isn't that what they always say? But it's about impossible to avoid worrying about what's going on these days. The government has used the war on guns, the war on drugs, and the war on terrorism to tear our Bill of Rights to shreds. But you can fight back. The 10th Amendment Center has proven it, racking up major victories. For example, when the U.S. government claimed authority in the NDAA to have the military kidnap and detain Americans without trial, the nullifiers got a law passed in California, declaring the state's refusal to ever participate in any such thing. Their latest project is offnow.org, nullifying the National Security Agency. They've already gotten model legislation introduced in California, Arizona, Oklahoma, Missouri, and Kansas, meant to limit the power of the NSA to spy on Americans in those states. We'd be fools to wait around for the U.S. Congress or courts to roll back Big Brother. Our best chance is nullification and interposition on the state level. Go to offnow.org, print out that model legislation, and get to work nullifying the NSA. The hero Edward Snowden has risked everything to give us this chance. Let's take it. Offnow.org. All right, guys, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. ScottHorton.org is my website. Got all my interview archives there, more than 3,000 of them now going back to 2003. And also my blog and my whole show archives in the chat room. That's at ScottHorton.org/chat. And I got all my old news articles, and I got a collection of documentaries that I think you might want to watch, take a look at, type of a thing. Watch a look. What? That's at ScottHorton.org/documentaries. And also, you can follow me on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at /ScottHortonShow. I warn you, though, I have finally discovered, I guess, that if you're going to like me on Facebook, you better check that box that says, no, really, I want to see this guy's stuff or else they'll never show you any of my posts ever. And what's cool is at least they admit to me how few people they show my post to. 21 people have seen this post. In fact, let's look at the post for today's show that I put up right after the top of the hour news started here. Let me hit refresh on my Facebook page. And it says 35 people saw this post. Out of 6,000 and a half or something likes, Facebook has shown my post to 35 people. And in fact, that doesn't really mean they saw it. That just means they gave it, 35 different people's news feeds had access to it at one point anyway. So if you want to actually see my posts on Facebook, you're going to have to find the checkbox and click it for show me the things that this guy posts. Damn it, what the hell is this? I think that's what the checkbox says. Anyway, on Twitter, you can follow me, same address, /ScottHortonShow. And same thing for my YouTube channel if you want to watch me give old speeches or whatever crap. That's YouTube.com/ScottHortonShow. So go and like me and share me and retweet me. Help get the word out. You know, it turns out a lot of people don't like this show, but it turns out also that the people who do like this show tend to really like it, it seems like. So why don't you go ahead and retweet me, man? Give me a good old retweet. Tell everybody how much you like the show. All right. Yeah. So yes, Obama's subhuman, but not because he's mixed race. Come on, man. What kind of back-ass words bigotry is that, dude? Who believes in that stupid crap anymore? He's subhuman because he's a murderer. He blows up little children to death. All the time. All the time. His third day in office. You know, George Bush waited until he was in office for, I believe it was 6 days before he bombed Iraq. Could have been 9 days. Barack Obama sent the CIA to kill children in Pakistan on his third day in office. And he's been killing children virtually every day since then. He's a child killer. He is subhuman. If there's a single human on Earth who has given up their humanity, he's the one. I mean, can you think of anyone on Earth who's killed more people than him? I mean, I guess Ayman al-Zawahiri. He's kind of helped that whole, I don't know, not really, man. He's just barking orders from a basement where he's hiding, which that's not much different than sitting in the Oval Office, is it? Ayman al-Zawahiri bears the responsibility for a lot of deaths in the Iraq War, but he's not the one who started it. I don't know. Let's see. I'm trying to think. Of all the worst dictators in the world, I guess the guys in Burma, they're pretty bad, but they're not anywhere near. They're not. They're like a child in a race with an Olympian compared to the brutality of Barack Obama. Vladimir Putin's never killed 1/10,000th the number of people Barack Obama has killed. In Afghanistan, tens and tens and tens of thousands of Afghans have died at Obama's hands. In Pakistan, more than 1,000, 2,000, somewhere right around there. In Somalia, oh, I don't know, man. You want to talk about, it's shades of gray. It's hard exactly to pin a number on how many people who died in the famine there are on Obama's watch. But you know what? We don't let Mao Zedong off for the people who died in his famine, do we? The people who died of Mao's famine died of Mao, didn't they? Just like Obama Zedong, the dictator of Somalia. And I'm not talking about withholding food aid or something. I'm talking about the war he inherited from George W. Bush and has waged this entire time. And has kept Somalia, the people, the society of Somalia, completely destabilized and unable to distribute food to the people starving for lack of it. According to Obama's own government, at least a U.S. government-sponsored NGO, FuseNet, 250,000 people starved to death in 2010 and 11 in Somalia. On Obama's watch, Obama's war. No different than, you know, sitting on the throne in Peking. And being responsible for the deaths of all the Chinese who died in Mao's ridiculous communist experiments and economy. You know what we should do? We should have a really small iron smelting plant in everyone's backyard. That's probably the best way to make sure that there's a fair share of iron for everyone. Oh, yeah. Lay down and die. The mountain of Somali skulls that Obama is sitting on right now is in at least the tens of thousands of his direct responsibility. At least in the tens of thousands. And then, of course, he started a war in Libya. He's been back in the Mujahideen in Somalia, Syria all this time. The war in Yemen has killed at least a few thousand people. And that's, you know, the drone war plus the proxy war being waged on the American government's dime, on the U.S. taxpayers' dime, and bondholders. And yeah, I mean, hell, if Obama hadn't insisted on a policy of regime change in Syria and hadn't told the rebels, oh, don't worry, we've got your back. Do not negotiate. do not settle for anything less than Assad's removal from power, than the war in Syria. And if he had told the Saudis to knock it off, and if he had told the CIA to stop coordinating all the Saudi and Qatari and Turkish and Jordanian aid and organization for the Mujahideen in Syria, the war would have been long over by now. And you're not even going to believe me. I got to wait till Margulies is on the show later on to get to this, because you're going to think I'm lying when I talk about these articles in the Wall Street Journal. U.S. revisits options on Syria as talks stall. And in Yahoo News, Obama may escalate role in Syria war. They're talking about intervening against the Mujahideen now. And the government. Just like John McCain said to Anderson Cooper the other day. He was implying, he sort of left off the subject. The actual noun at the beginning of his sentence was deleted on the way out of his mouth. It sort of sounded like he was implying, yeah, the moderate rebels there. But I guess he really was referring to the U.S. after all, saying, yes, it's a two-front war between the jihadis and the Ba'athists. Now, back in the days of George W. Bush, America paid the Ba'athists to torture the jihadis to death and disappear them off the face of the earth. Now, I'm not saying that's a good thing. America shouldn't have ever intervened in Syria in either way. But now, they have to admit that it's a gigantic lie, the one foisted on us by McCain's advisor, right, Elizabeth O'Baggy, and foisted on us by our current Secretary of State, John Kerry, in their bogus hearings before the Senate, before the Armed Services Committee last year, last summer, that, oh, yeah, no, it's a secular uprising, man. In Syria, it's everybody versus the government. The jihadists are a tiny minority. No, the place started laughing, like Chinese students saying they could bet on the dollar forever. They just, bah, what? Yeah, right. Well, they've had to admit that, you know what? The Sunni-based insurgency in Syria, if you look at it, yeah, they're a bunch of suicide bombers and prisoner beheaders. So we're just going to have to pretend that there's this mythical moderate force that no one can name that we need to back, because Benjamin Netanyahu's Likudnik policy comes first in America, apparently, virtually always. And that is, we have to have regime change in Damascus. We must see the end of the Ba'athist regime in Damascus. And why? You know, I'm always looking for a grand design, if I think there is one. And I can see where the Yanan plan and the clean break strategy, coping with crumbling states, all that, let's turn the Middle East into a bunch of warring tribes, that fits the model here. But really, is that more compelling, doing what Israel wants? I mean, to the American empire, is that more compelling, the Yanan plan of breaking up all of the Arab states into warring tribal factions, you know, sub-state, you know, warring tribes, so that Israel is never threatened by nationalism, Arab nationalism again, kind of a thing? Could that really be more important to the American empire than maintaining an alliance with a Ba'athist regime that is helping to keep Al-Qaeda down? Apparently so. They made the same calculation in Libya. Gaddafi had one real argument for letting him back into the fold, which was, I'm good at keeping Al-Qaeda down. Because, you know, he was some sort of pseudo-Marxist, whatever, kind of military dictator there. And the Mujahideen would just as soon kill him. And in both cases, Obama has sided with the Mujahideen. And now they're saying their excuse to get into the war, whatever excuse they need, is now, it's not to intervene on the side of the Mujahideen like last summer, it's now they're saying that the Mujahideen are the threat after all. But also they want to fight Assad too. This is in the Wall Street Journal. You think I'm making this crap up? It's not. I mean, they may be, but I don't think so. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation at fff.org/subscribe. Since 1989, FFF has been pushing an uncompromising moral and economic case for peace, individual liberty, and free markets. Sign up now for The Future Freedom, featuring founder and president Jacob Hornberger, as well as Sheldon Richmond, James Bovard, Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, and many more. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's fff.org/subscribe, and tell them Scott sent you. Hey y'all, Scott Horton here for CashIntoCoins.com. So you want to buy some Bitcoins? CashIntoCoins.com makes it fast, easy, and safe to get Bitcoins. Just deposit the money into their account at any of the major banks they support, and then just email them a picture of the receipt and your Bitcoin address, and you get your Bitcoins. Almost always the same day it clears. In a tough, competitive new market, CashIntoCoins.com has the advantage. A great system and great customer service to keep you coming back. That's CashIntoCoins.com. Just click the link in the right margin at ScottHorton.org. Hey, y'all. Welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. And our first guest on the show today is my old friend Greg Pallast. He's the author of The Best Democracy Money Can Buy. And let's see, also Armed Madhouse. And I think the latest is Vulture's Picnic. And his website, of course, is GregPallast.com. Welcome back to the show. Greg, how the hell are you?
Pretty good, trying to survive the regime. And, by the way, I heard you were trying to convince people to download Dirty Wars. They better do that. The director and cinematographer is, Rick Raleigh, mm-hmm. Ricardo, as he's called in Vulture's Picnic. And, he is also the director cinematographer of a terrific film called The Assassination of Hugo Chavez. Which I'm going to, as of this moment, I just had my dear Ms. Badpenny put up on our site for Scott Horton listeners. You can download that as well for free.
Oh, great.
Rick Raleigh's other film, and it happens to be reported by not a great reporter like Jeremy Scahill, but second-rate reporter Greg Pallast. So if you want to get the real story of Venezuela, you can go to GregPallast.com, download it for free.
Cool. Yeah, and in fact, it's because of you that I know of Rick Raleigh, because of his great reporting out of Iraq and the sectarian cleansing of the Shiites from the Sunni provinces during the worst of the surge. Well, that might have been 2006 or something, actually.
Yeah, and, well, Rick has been, Ricardo has been, he was taken hostage in Basra. He's always doing crazy stuff that he works with me. If you don't know Greg Pallast, I also report for BBC Television. These reports on Hugo Chavez and the assassination of Hugo Chavez and my films about Venezuela and South America were done for BBC Television Newsnight with Raleigh. And you'll see, my discussions with President Chavez, with the people, with the guy who took him hostage and kidnapped him, with the opposition, and, the whole crew. And also, if you go to my site, I don't know if it's in the film, but you'll see the current president who came and visited me when he was in New York, Nicolas Maduro. So, it's the usual. It's very interesting stuff happening in Venezuela today. So go ahead. If you have any questions, I'll answer.
Yeah, in fact, I'd like to go back and talk about the 2002 stuff in a minute because, of course, it is important context. I have some questions about that, mm-hmm. Why don't you go ahead and give us your rundown about what's really going on there right now, as opposed to what they're trying to show me on CNN? I'm sure you have your own view.
There's actually what's happening in Venezuela, and what started in Venezuela has gone worldwide, a kind of Occupy Wall Street by the 1%. So there's kind of a counter-revolutionary uprising by the world's 1%. In Thailand, you have the upper middle class and the wealthy who have shut down the government. They don't want elections because they know they'll lose. Democracy is very uncomfortable for the plutocrats. So you have these mass demonstrations in the street. In other words, they've learned their lesson of Occupy Wall Street. So they're much more violent. They take over government buildings. They burn buildings. They're armed. This happened in Thailand. It's moved to the Ukraine. In fact, right now, the Greg Pallast photographer team member, Zach Roberts, is on a flight to the Ukraine as we speak. And the same stories happened in Venezuela. Now, I went down to Venezuela for BBC a number of times. And what we're seeing now is what I've seen for years. You have the wealthy of Venezuela March. It's very funny. And you'll see, and that's covered in the U.S. press. These massive marches. They are big, by the way. You'll see tens, literally tens of thousands of people marching against the Chavista government. Now Chavez is dead, but now we have his chosen successor who was elected, Nicolas Maduro. And, you know, so you'll see tens of thousands of people in the street against the current government. And then you'll see 100 or 200,000 people in the street for the government. That's completely not covered in the U.S. press. It's all about the, you know, repressing, repressing the demonstrators. And for example, we had a New York Times reporter, actually, I remember, asked Chavez, who was elected overwhelmingly, and no one has challenged the veracity of those elections. You know, I mean, it's mostly poor people, and they vote for their candidate. Asking Chavez when he was going to give up power. Now, can you imagine if he turned around and asked George Bush or Ronald Reagan or Obama, listen, when are you going to give up power? It's like, well, it's called democracy when people vote in someone else. So you see this. So why is it, by the way, why is the U.S.?
Well, now, wait a minute. Hang on. Let me clarify something here, Greg, because when you're talking about the competing demonstrations, I remember last time. Well, and this may have happened numerous times, but I'm certainly remembering back around 02 era or whatever, where you did have the massive demonstrations against Chavez, and then it was your reporting that said, oh, yeah? Well, point the camera to the left over here. Look, everybody. And then there's 10 times as many people in support. But is that going on now? Because there is a blackout if there is a large turnout in support of the government.
It's always been a blackout. In fact, I actually had in my book Our Madhouse, but I took out the section because it was like my readers already know this stuff about bent media. Literally, the front page of the New York Times, front page San Francisco Chronicle, it said, thousands demonstrate against Chavez regime. This was a front page giant photos in the New York Times, San Francisco Chronicle. I was in San Francisco at the time. Yes, and it's true. The pictures were not phony. What they didn't show is that a demonstration at least 5 to 10 times as big was pro-Chavez, completely non-mentioned. It wasn't even mentioned. Do we get bent news in America? That's why you're on the air, Scott, because it's bent and you've got to bend it back. You got to straighten it out, okay? And that's one of the big problems. Now, this time, I will say, from what I know, that the proportions have changed. It used to be that if there's a demonstration of 10,000 anti-government people, there would be 100,000 pro-government. Now you get 40,000 anti-government and 60,000 pro-government. People are getting, there's no question that the anti-government forces have gained a lot more popular support. Before, they were a joke. They were just literally the rich. In fact, when you see the demonstration, it's funny. You see the poor people demonstrating for the current government, the Chavez government then, and, you know, in their jeans and old cowboy hats. And they literally, I got a lot of flack for this, but it's really true. I'm photographing for the demonstration of the rich, women marching through the shopping district with screaming, kill Chavez, kill him in English, you know, in high heels and push-up bras and, like, you know, bright lipstick. It was a cartoon, right? It was like the demonstration of the trophy wives. And I'm sorry people are offended by that, but you got to see the film, my film, and you'll see it. But now it's widened out. The opposition of Chavez has widened out because of it's been many years. I mean, the Chavez government has
real bad price inflation, and that'll get you booted out of office every time when people go to the store and the price of bread and milk just keeps going up, 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 and these are things that you need now. You know,
right. So whatever the reasons, and the Chavez can say, well, our government's being sabotaged, etc., whatever it is, you now have. Before, there was zero question. You know, the U.S. government used to talk about, oh, how Chavez wrecked the economy. And maybe for the 1%, they didn't live too badly. But the average person in Venezuela was enormously better off under Chavez. And they felt it, and they believed it. What's happening now is, in a way, the Chavez government, and I call it the Chavez government because Maduro is simply the shadow of the living shadow of Chavez. I know Maduro, and he really is just a shadow. in my opinion, now I'm giving an opinion, I usually don't deal with elections, but he was not a great choice successor. He's not a leader. He's a politician and a good union leader, but he's not a president, you know, and that's one of the problems, that he's not an articulate leader and a strong leader, which Venezuelans like. So what's happened now is that there is no question that he's been this victim of his own success. Suddenly you have literally hundreds of thousands of kids who wouldn't even get any schooling are suddenly college graduates after 20 years of Chavista power. You have people joining the middle class, and you know where you stand depends on where you sit. That is, so what's happened is, in a way, that Chavistas have created their own opposition by making people wealthier. So now you have all these people who are middle class. You have all these kids with college degrees. You have all these students who are saying they don't remember the bad old days of a nation, a third world nation on its butt and impoverished where they didn't stand a chance. They don't remember any of that. All they know is that, like you say, the price of bread has gone up. They graduate from college. They thought they were going to be dentists, and they can't afford a new car. So, you know, they don't say, oh, gee, you know, if it weren't for Chavez and the Chavista government, I wouldn't be a dentist today. All they know is that they say, hey, wait a minute, I just went to college, and I, you know, and I'm being paid as much as my father makes as, you know, as a baker, and I can't afford the bread.
Well, it's so a lot of working-class people out there, too, right? Or is that just in the spin?
That's just in the spin. Well, when you say the working-class people, no, that's just in the spin. It's middle class, but understand,
I mean, price inflation can hurt somebody who lives paycheck to paycheck pretty bad, too, right?
Everyone. Okay, the current price inflation there is harming everyone, so that real incomes are declining. And eventually, and I got to tell you my prediction, and here's my prediction. The Chavista government's always been committed to democracy. I mean, Chavez, when he tried to change the Constitution so he could run for an extra term, lost by 0.5%. You don't see, you know, the U.S. talks about dictatorial power. George Bush lost by more than 0.5% in Florida. He wasn't going to give up power, right? But Chavez, while he was upset about losing the election, accepted the verdict of the people. I think you will see, and I saw this when I was in Nicaragua, when people got tired of the socialist slogans. It's because every voter always says, yeah, that was 20 years ago. What about today? And I think that you're going to see if the opposition in Venezuela, which is split in half, does put itself together, that the Maduro government cannot get reelected. I think it will be close, but I don't see them getting reelected at this moment unless they do something to stop the economic fall.
Mm-hmm. All right, now we're about to have to take a break, so this is a good time to remind people that Maduro was elected in the first place in fair elections that no one really contested. And in fact, his party won local elections, and the opposition lost out in the local elections later. For what that's worth, this is not, you know, an American-backed dictator like Mubarak being overthrown by the people out in Tahrir Square. This is something else altogether.
Right.
And then when we get back, though, we need to talk about who are these opposition leaders and what does the NED or USAID or any of those nefarious actors have to do with it? What about Houston, Texas? What's their position? Greg Palast is on the line, author of Our Madhouse and Vulture's Picnic. GregPalast.com. We'll be right back after this. Man, you need some new stickers for the back of your truck. Scott Horton here for LibertyStickers.com. Aren't you sick and tired of everyone else being wrong about everything all the time? Well, now you can tell them all what's right with some stickers from LibertyStickers.com. At LibertyStickers.com, they're against everything, so you know they're good on your issue, too. Whether it's the wars, police state, gun laws, the left and right, or the president, LibertyStickers.com has hundreds of choices so you can find just the right words to express your opposition and contempt for those who would violate your rights. That's LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. What was the only interest group in D.C. pushing war with Syria last summer? AIPAC and the Israel lobby. What's the only interest group in D.C. pushing to sabotage the nuclear deal with Iran right now? AIPAC and the Israel lobby. Why doesn't the president force an end to the occupation of Palestine, a leading cause of terrorist attacks against the United States? AIPAC and the Israel lobby. The Council for the National Interest is pushing back, putting America first and educating the people about what's really at stake in the Middle East. Help support their important work at councilforthenationalinterest.org. All right, y'all, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. I'm talking to my old buddy, Greg Palast. First time in a little while, I'd say. GregPalast.com is the website. Vulture's Picnic is the book. And we're talking about Venezuela and the putsch out in the street going on? I don't know. Sort of seems like it. What exactly are the demands of the upper-class protesters here, Greg, trying to cancel the last election?
Well, what they're trying to do is in a way, and the students are going to be shocked if they win, because and they may. That is in the election, next election. The Chavistas have been a long time. They're going to lose the next election, be my guess. And then they're going to find out something, as the opposition found out when they beat the Sandinistas in election, that the Uncle Sam ain't going to come in and say, oh, we love you now, and we're going to write big checks to you, and everything will be fine. No, just the opposite. At the moment, the only thing that's keeping what keeps Venezuela alive and made it wealthy is oil. This is about oil. Believe it or not, Scott, oil is the story here. Venezuela is one of the world's biggest producers of oil. It has, officially, if you look at the OPEC and U.S. Department of Energy sites, it is Venezuela, not Saudi Arabia, which has by far the world's largest reserve of oil. This is about the control of the world's largest reserve of oil. And in particular, Venezuela is the main source of high sulfur oil, heavy oil, super heavy oil. It's filthy oil. It's really heavy, gunky stuff. And you say, well, why do we want that? Well, I don't know about you or me, but the refineries in Houston and in the Houston area, Corpus Christi, are designed only for Venezuelan oil, super heavy oil, and that's owned by Koch Industries. I know everyone says, oh, he's bringing up the Koch brothers. Well, what do you want me to do? The number one purchaser of Venezuela's oil is Koch Industries in Corpus Christi, Texas. They're completely dependent on Venezuelan oil. And Venezuela, instead of giving a discount because their oil is crappy and heavy, actually charges a premium because they know the Kochs have no other alternative source of oil. The only alternative that the Kochs have would be Canadian super heavy oil, otherwise known as tar sands oil, and that means the XL pipeline. Unless and until there's an XL pipeline, the Kochs are dependent on Venezuela and the Chavistas. They would love a government. The Koch brothers would love a government that would cut the price of oil to Houston. And if that happens, all the people in the streets that are screaming for cheaper bread and continuing subsidies, like you can buy gasoline there for about 8 cents a gallon, that people want the continued subsidies, are going to find out that after they throw out the Chavistas, that things are going to be even more expensive. Because bread doesn't grow on trees. You have to cost money, and it's paid for by oil. And unless they're going to give the Kochs a discount, they're going to give them a discount on the oil. They're going to have less money, the government.
Well, but how much less? I mean, give me some percentages and some tens of billions of dollars and things. Because, I mean, if you're telling me they're sitting on, and I remember you explaining before, back when the price was too low, that once the price is high enough, Venezuelan oil will be, the largest amount, larger than Saudi Arabia. How could they possibly not be able to afford all the welfare in the world sitting on that pile of
money? Well, the answer is, at the moment, because tar sand, the heavy oil, like tar sands in Alaska, is very, very expensive to produce. So while Venezuela produces today about roughly 2 million barrels a day of oil, and mostly lighter, super heavy oil and then heavy oil, to open up those monster reserves is going to require something in the order of $100 billion of investment, and so they're not.
I'll just have Janet Yellen print that.
Yeah, and so to get that $100 billion, Venezuela need help from several sources, including the U.S. companies and the Chinese companies and others, to develop that oil, but they have to maintain, the price of oil has to stay up high. Obviously, it's a fight over who's going to control that ultimate reserve and at what price, they're going to pay for it. Now, the previous government, the pre-Chavez government, was charging 1% royalty for the super heavy oil, 16% royalty for the lighter oil, compared to Saudi Arabia, which is about 87% royalty, for example. So when Chavez got it, he said 1% is a little cheap, guys. Don't you think the government of Venezuela ought to get a little bit more than 1%? Mm-hmm. And he was following the lead of the socialist governor of Alaska, Sarah Palin, who had doubled the royalties on oil companies there.
Mm-hmm.
And so he tried to double the royalties on oil companies in taking his oil, Venezuela's oil, out of Venezuela. And so in 2002, a coup was engineered to overthrow him. Now, today, the U.S. government is very interested in, again, of that oil. And, you know, so...
Your call waiting interrupted there. Say again?
The U.S. government is very interested in maintaining and taking control of that oil. Right now, they are in wars with where the Chinese are saying, if the Koch brothers don't want to pay the premium price for your oil, which was they were charging, Venezuela was charging about $103 a barrel last time I looked, about $5 above the international price. If the Kochs won't pay the premium, China will take it. And that's what's upsetting them. We need a government there that won't sell it off to China.
Would you connect the dots between, and I remember in your old book, Best Democracy Money Can Buy, you connect the dots between the Koch's bribery and breaking the law in the Republican Revolution in 94 with the acquittal in the Senate of Bill Clinton in 1998 you guys protect us and we'll protect you kind of thing.
That's right.
So would you connect the dots here that the Kochs are lobbying the state to get rid of these commies right now? Is that what's really going on here? Or just these are the interests in a vague way?
You have to understand, the reason why my film, again, I'm offering it for a free download at gregpals.com, it's called The Assassination of Hugo Chavez. By the way, Chavez did not die from assassination. He wasn't killed. He kind of did himself in by doing, I knew him well, he did about 30 cups of coffee a day and got stomach cancer. So he wasn't killed. So don't assume that the title means that. It's about the continuing attempts to get him assassinated, and not by pouring him more coffee. But you have to understand, they don't need the Koch brothers to do that, even though the Koch brothers are the, being overcharged or being charged to the hilt by the Venezuelans. There is something else that the Chavista government did, which is nationalize companies that threaten to move out. You threaten to close your business in Venezuela, they don't say, we'll give you extra tax breaks. They say, if you leave, we'll simply nationalize your plant. And one of the biggest plants nationalized in Venezuela was the gigantic ketchup plant owned by a guy named John Kerry. I don't know what he's doing today. I don't know his latest job, but he's Secretary of State. So the Secretary of State of the United States,
big tomato,
one of his big plants, John Kerry, the Heinz ketchup, lost its big giant ketchup manufacturing plant in Venezuela. They threatened to close it. So Chavez said, "You're not going to if you don't give us tax breaks, you don't allow us to cut wages," because they'd raised the minimum wage. So Chavez said, if you don't pay, we'll take you over, and he did. So Heinz lost one of the biggest ketchup packing operations in
Latin America. Lots of motive, Greg, but we're almost out of time. Tell me, what do you know about CIA, NED, USAID, actual American interference in this crisis today?
Plenty, because what's happening is that the NED is National Endowment for Democracy. It seems to be spending a lot of its money trying to overthrow a democratically elected government. I can't say that the help is overwhelming. What they've done is that they kind of train the opposition in low level street mayhem. They train them. I actually, to be very honest, I think that the NED's help to these guys is pretty minimal. What has been the bigger threat is groups like what used to be called the Wackenhut Corporation, who are actually involved in attempts at assassination. I think that while the U.S. government is pushing very heavily to support this kind of uprising of the plutocrats, in the end, as you say, people are going to go into the streets if they can't afford the bread. But there's no doubt that the U.S. and our current Secretary of State, the great Democrat John Kerry, has been viciously and violently against the democratically elected government of Venezuela. And it's about time the U.S. stand up for democratically elected governments. You know, I'm not – that's one thing. You know, if the Chavistas lose, then they have to leave office, no matter who backed them or whatever. But that's the problem here, is that the U.S. doesn't understand there is blowback from pushing to overthrow democratically elected governments, whether it's in Thailand, the Ukraine, mm-hmm. Venezuela, Nicaragua. We can force regime change through manipulation, but that will come back to haunt us. And, you know,
A guilty conscience, too, you know, because when they talk about it on TV, they just never mention whether there were elections or not. They just sort of let it sound like these are all Mubarak's in Ukraine.
Yeah, and you know, so then what will happen is that we'll suddenly find that we have an excuse to send in the drones or whatever. You know, if you didn't like blood for oil, I don't see how it's going to be better to have blood for ketchup. You know, this is the problem here. We have a Secretary of State who's basically trying to get even for the nationalization of his property.
Yeah. Same old story with these guys, just like the Dulles brothers and United Fruit Company back in Guatemala and all that. All right, we got to go. We're all out of time. Thanks very much, Greg. Good to talk to you again.
You're very welcome. Bye, Scott.
See ya. Everybody, that's the great Greg Palast. He's at gregpalast.com. He's the author of Vulture's Picnic. And we'll be back with Eric Margulies on Ukraine after this. Hey, y'all, Scott here. First, I want to take a second to thank all the show's listeners, sponsors, and supporters for helping make this show what it is. I literally couldn't do it without you. And now I want to tell you about the newest way to help support the show. Whenever you shop at Amazon.com, stop by ScottHorton.org first and just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page. That way, the show will get a kickback from Amazon's end of the sale. It won't cost you an extra cent. And it's not just books. Amazon.com sells just about everything in the world, except cars, I think. So whatever you need, they've got it. Just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page at ScottHorton.org or go to ScottHorton.org/Amazon. All right, you guys, welcome back to the thing here. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. And we're lucky enough to have Eric Margulies back on today. He writes at ericmargulies.com, spelled like Margolis. ericmargulies.com. He's the author of War at the Top of the World and American Raj, Liberation or Domination. And you can also find his articles. You can find them at ericmargulies.com, and you can also find them at lourockwell.com and at unz.com, U-N-Z, unz.com. Welcome back to the show, Eric. How are you doing?
I'm fine. I'm, as always, glad to be back with you, Scott.
Well, good deal. I'm very happy that I have you around to explain to me what the hell is going on in the world, because there's a lot of it. And since you've seen it all already, and reported it all, you're about the best at explaining it. Especially when it comes to far-off lands like Ukraine. So I guess the big news is, according to CNN anyway, that the public square is empty. A truce has been called. An agreement has been made that they're going to have elections at some point later in the year, and that the president's going to give up some powers to his prime minister, and I'm not exactly sure who worked the deal, if you got better details than that, but apparently... The spiral out of control has halted. But then again, I think I heard something too about there was a big fist fight in the parliament about whether the deal was really on or not or what. So tell me what you think.
Well, it's very good news. You know, it's an imperfect deal. It could break down, but it stopped the rush to what looked to me like possible war. I mean, we were really in a dangerous situation. Not only was Ukraine facing civil war internally, and the army was about to intervene there. We don't know what would have happened with the army. It might have broken apart or moved against the people. But the U.S. and Russia were on a confrontation and on a collision course over Ukraine. With last week, the White House speaking of consequences if the Russians didn't pull in their horns and stop supporting the pro-Russian Ukrainian government. Very dangerous talk. Obviously, you don't remember as far back as the Cuban Missile Crisis. So there was an enormous amount to be worried about. But fortunately, cooler heads prevailed and a compromise agreement brokered by the European Union was put into effect, and it's a big success.
Mm-hmm. And now the EU doing this, is this the kind of thing that the Americans were trying to thwart, or this is them finally getting their act together and doing the gluing that the Americans were pushing them to do, and we're trying to, in fact, we're growing impatient with, and we're ready to push them aside, as revealed in that leaked phone call between the American ambassador to the EU and the American ambassador to Ukraine last week, or 2 weeks ago?
Well, it was a delicious moment for lovers of irony, because as you say, Victoria Nuland, our neoconservative assistant secretary of state for European affairs, was recorded in Ukraine talking on the phone, which she should never have been doing, when the question of the EU pushing forth their program of compromise, she said, fuck the EU, we'll do it ourselves, and we'll issue threats. Well, this is a perfect example of the lack of IQ that's prevalent in our foreign policy right now. This woman should be fired, and Europe deserves congratulations for its patience and perseverance.
Mm-hmm. Well, and, you know, in that thing, they were really just arguing about the EU isn't moving fast enough, right? So is this really what she was trying to get them to do or not, you think?
Well, no, Scott, I wrote a column about it. I think there was much more to it than that, because what she said so pithily was perfectly demonstrates the neocon arrogant attitudes towards Europe. Europe, it's old Europe. It doesn't matter what Europe says. You know, the Donald Rumsfeld old Europe idea during the Gulf War. Europe is jejune. It's a spent force. We don't have to work with Europe or listen to them. They're just a bunch of pathetic old fogies. Well, the neocons don't like Europe because they are not anxious to let us have our wars, and they are sometimes even mildly critical of Israel. And put these two things together, and it's anathema to the neocons. But at least the latest foolishness from them has been shown up by these events in Ukraine. I hope earnestly that this process will stick. Ukrainians are hotheads. There are a lot of angry people there, but I think even they realized that they were approaching the abyss.
Mm. All right. Now, a friend just sent me a link to an article where they say that, or I guess they're quoting the BBC as saying, one of the stipulations of the deal is that the 2004 Constitution will be restored. And then what that means is that all the police power is handed from the president over to, or I mean, actual control of the security forces is handed over to the parliament, which, in other words, sort of, according to this writer here, this is basically giving up everything that Yanukovych, that's how you say it, has basically capitulated entirely.
I don't think so. No, I could be, but I don't read it that way. Some of his powers have been reduced. He will. I don't know what level of control he's going to have over parliament. We have not seen it yet, because there's a temporary coalition government until elections, which will be fairly soon. If the prime minister comes from his party, then he'll still have substantial power. If it doesn't, then he'll be forced into what the French called cohabitation, where you had a president and a prime minister of different parties.
Mm. You know, it's funny, when I was hurriedly typing your name into Google to pull up your website, it pulled up a picture of you with the gas princess, with her Princess Leia haircut and everything, Yulia Tymoshenko, at some dinner party or something.
Lovely Yulia. A very charming and attractive woman.
And they're letting her out of jail now, they said.
I've heard that, and I certainly hope so. She was thrown in jail by the Yanukovych forces on trumped-up charges, we think. She was charged with some kind of financial peculation and hanky-panky in the Ukrainian gas business, but it's so complex and Byzantine that nobody really understands it. It's like running Tammany Hall, City Hall in New York. It's beyond explanation. Mm-hmm. But hopefully she'll be out because she's been very ill. She has severe back problems. But boy, once they let her out of jail, she's gonna be very, very, become a whirlwind.
Yeah, that's interesting. I'm trying to remember now. I thought that I had read that. What's the guy's name who with the whole poison hoax and everything? The last guy from the Orange Revolution.
Hold on.
I know, it's on the tip of my tongue, too.
Yanukovych and, put me on the spot here.
He did the whole Emperor Palpatine.
Yushchenko.
Look what the Jedi did to me. Now give me the power. And anyway.
Yushchenko is his name. Yushchenko.
Right. And then so he and Timoshenko had a falling out, and I had thought that he had accused her of tilting toward. Because they were in the Orange Revolution together as partners, right? And then she split off, and
yes.
I'm trying to remember which of them was accusing. I think he was accusing her of tilting back toward Putin, and that was the fight that got her ended up locked in jail.
Well, it was personal rivalries. The whole thing was very childish, and not Athenian democracy by any means. Almost worthy of our own U.S. Congress, for God's sake. But, no, they fell out. You never know, they might come back. But Yushchenko kind of was completely, his name was blackened. He lost all credibility because he did poorly as president.
All right, now, let's see, we're almost out of time here. So I guess, I'll ask for a comment on the media here. They'll show all the riots and talk about, well, it's the government versus the people out in the street there, and they really don't care. They'll go on, they'll carry on all on the internet and all on the TV channels too. They'll just carry on pushing whatever narrative is foisted in front of them for all of us to feast on. Do you ever notice how bad it is? Did you notice this time around?
I've been writing for the last 20 years or 15 years that our North American media has become as bad and as corrupt as the old Soviet media was when I was covering Russia, Soviet Union. Right. It has been really disgraceful. They're obeying government orders. It's a propaganda campaign worthy of the old Stalinist era. They've really made themselves look very, very poor.
We'll be right back with more Eric Margolies right after this. Hey, y'all, Scott here. Man, I had a chance to have an essay published in the book Why Peace, edited by Mark Gutman, but I didn't understand what an opportunity it was. Boy, do I regret I didn't take it. This compendium of thoughts by the greatest anti-war writers and activists of our generation will be remembered and studied long into the future. You've got to get Why Peace. You've got to read Why Peace. It features articles by Harry Brown, Robert Naiman, Fred Bronfman, Dahlia Wasfi, Richard Cummings, Karen Kotowski, Butler Schaefer, Kathy Kelly, Robert Higgs, Anthony Gregory, and so many more. Why peace? Because war is the health of everything wrong with our society. Get Why Peace. Down at the bookshop or Amazon.com. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. I'm talking with the great Eric Margolies, ericmargolies.com. And American Raj, Liberation or Domination, is his most recent book. And I was going to ask you, I guess, I had read this thing this morning that was saying all the trashing of Russia and probably even part of all the hawkish talk on the Ukraine crisis is really anger at Putin for not going along with American plans in Syria. And then I thought that was breaking news that the Americans had plans in Syria. I mean, I knew they had activities, but I didn't think that they had a plan. I was wondering if you think so. I'm reading in the Wall Street Journal that they think that maybe now they'll intervene against the Mujahideen they've been supporting all this time, Eric.
I think Putin, and I wrote the same thing, did the U.S. a great favor and pulled our bacon out of the fire over Syria, because Obama and his incompetent advisors had foolishly boxed themselves into a corner by threatening Syria and all the red lines, and if you don't do this, watch out, we're going to get you. And when their bluff was called and what were they going to do then? Start a little war in Syria against whom? Who were they going to bomb? What would happen next? They really hadn't thought it through. Just the way, as I was saying earlier, these foolish threats against Russia over Ukraine, there will be consequences. Putin is just the type of person to call such a bluff and make the bluffers look awfully foolish. So, no, I think Putin really did Obama a big favor.
And now, I mean, are they really serious? What the hell is going on? I try my best to just, you know, remote view the Oval Office discussion or whatever in my imagination. What in the hell are they talking about in there where the discussion goes from back in the Mujahideen, somebody decided this is okay, let's work with Prince Bandar on this, and we'll go ahead and we'll back this giant Mujahideen force there for the last 2.5-3 years now. And then now they're saying, well, geez, well, not that we need to back Assad like George W. Bush against the Mujahideen, but maybe now we need to fight both at the same time. A two-front war like John McCain was pushing on CNN the night before last.
Well,
are they smoking crack up there or snorting PCP up their nose? Or I don't know.
Yeah, I think it's like I used to have a T-shirt in Vietnam days saying, kill them all and let God sort them out.
That was you, huh?
Yeah, that was me. They're utter confusion in the White House. These are know-nothing people who are dealing with a very difficult, complicated, and arcane situation there in Syria. And they shouldn't be allowed. Their grown-ups should be handling it, not these amateurs. They are, and we have had a reflex, knee-jerk thing here in the United States since 2001, is that we react to so many threats and problems by military response. Here we go again. No brain power, all brawn. That is not going to solve the current situation. And in fact, we're just getting ourselves deeper and deeper, because the bottom line is that America's natural ally in the region is President Assad and his regime, his secular regime in Syria. And we've ended up, out of our own stupidity, of getting our people who want to drive the United States out of the Middle East. These are the jihadists, who we call terrorists. They're now our allies, and we really ignited this terrible war in Syria, and we bear a large responsibility for the millions of refugees that it has caused.
Well, and you know, I'm not certain if you saw this thing in the Wall Street Journal, but this is basically the Chalabi plan from 1996 for Iraq, where, you know, we'll just invade a little part of it, and that'll be the rally point, and we'll just need like 5,000 guys. And remember that? Like, what are you doing?
I do.
I mean, they're saying here they're going to have a limited no-fly zone, and they're going to build up some moderate force, which they haven't found yet. And, I mean, this is crazy what they're talking about here. I mean, I can imagine an army general being told, yeah, you're going to put just enough guys out there to get killed, but not enough to protect themselves. And
oh, yeah.
I guess they're going to go along, right?
Well, Pentagon will have apoplexy. Fortunately, our generals are not stupid enough, usually, to support such ideas. So there will be resistance, I'm sure. But, you know, after just having stumbled in Syria and getting our pants whipped in Afghanistan and almost gotten ourselves into a head-on confrontation with Russia over Ukraine, here we are stumbling into Syria. And as we were saying before, the American media is launching constant propaganda, invective, and barrages against Putin and against Russia that is very scary. There's some kind of guiding force behind all of this. The American corporate media has gotten orders to go after Russia, bombard them, and to me, this has all the smell of Europe about 1910.
Yeah, well, I don't like it when you talk like that, because I know that you know what you're talking about real good there. I'm reading this guy, Stephen Cohen, in The Nation, saying, he was asking kind of rhetorically there in his article, has any Russian leader since Stalin been so vilified in the American media? I mean, this is really, Vladimir Putin, he's no nice guy if you got to live under him or whatever, but think about all of the tens of millions of Eastern Europeans and Central Asians who don't live under him because the Soviet Union's 25 years gone now.
Well, what Putin has done is he's brought Russia up from its knees, and Russia is standing up now. It's resuming its strength. And it, whereas under Yeltsin, we pretty well gave Russia its marching orders and controlled it financially, this is no longer the case. And Putin really has made Russia able to support its own interests. And he is trying to stop Western NATO expansion to Russia's borders, which we promised we would never do in 1991. We have been doing. We broke our vow to Mikhail Gorbachev. And Putin has been very successful with this. And he's respected around the world for being a competent leader. And we can't stand this. So the word is out to attack and bring down Putin. And also he makes another good target. The Muslims have failed to step into the shoes of the Soviet Union as a big boogeyman. Maybe they're going to bring the old Ruskies back again.
Mm. Do you think their plan is still to, or I guess, was it ever really to completely destroy Russia, to tear it apart into, I don't know, 10 more pieces or 15?
Well, I don't know. Somewhere in the bowels of the military-industrial complex, there is a plan to undermine Russia, for sure. Otherwise, we wouldn't be footsing around in Georgia, in the Black Sea area, up in the Baltics, in Central Asia. I think there is. We'd like to bring down Russia, peel off a few more parts of it, and make it a weak middle power rather than a significant power that can oppose American strategic policies in the Middle East and Central Asia and the Caucasus region.
Yeah. Which, of course, makes what should be all of our number one priority, getting rid of all the hydrogen bombs, impossible, right? I mean, if we were a normal country in a normal time and treated Russia as an independent, separate, upper middle class power that it is compared to the old USSR anyway, then maybe we could actually have a discussion about getting rid of these H-bombs. But as long as this is going on, forget about it. They're not going to give up anything.
You're quite right, Scott. This makes it very difficult to conduct any meaningful strategic arms reduction negotiation talks. And as I've been saying for years, like a prophet in the wilderness, ranting and raving, the most important priority for the United States, a diplomatic priority, is to maintain even relations with Russia, because Russia has a couple thousand nuclear warheads pointed at us. We cannot afford to be on bad terms with a country that can wipe us off the map, start World War III. It should be untouchable. All should be smile and calm relations. Instead, we're going out of our way to irritate and to annoy Russia. We've just sent warships into the Black Sea. Imagine if Russian warships were sitting on Lake Ontario. Hysteria that there would be in the States. So we're antagonizing Russia, and we're giving the Russians, even though we may not mean to destroy Russia, we're giving a lot of Russian security people the idea that we're back to our old Cold War plans of tearing down the Russian Federation.
Man, they should give Putin a regular column in the New York Times. I thought he was really good there.
He is very good.
He has a wry sense of humor, you know?
He does. I don't like some of his brutal policies, and he's surely an autocrat. But the way he destroyed the Chechen independence movement was really bloodthirsty. But on the other hand, he's a lot smarter than our Western leaders, and he shows it. And he's a man who's literate. Well, he's typical. The KGB from whence he came in the 1990s were the creme de la creme of Soviet society. They were well-educated. They knew what was going on. And they eventually, as I was told when I was at KGB headquarters, that they were eventually going to overthrow the Communist Party and take over running Russia.
Well, there you go. I bet you wrote about that before it happened too, didn't you?
I did.
Of course. All right. That's Eric Margolese, War at the Top of the World, American Raj. Those are the books, ericmargolese.com, lourockwell.com, uns.com. Thanks very much, Eric. Appreciate it again.
Cheers to God.
Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. If this nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone, we are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org or thewarstate.com. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. Well, someone's asking for my Clinton rant, and I'm trying to remember. Who was it that emailed me about that? Anyway, you have to go back through the archives. It was the last segment of a show. Was it the 12th? It might have been the 12th. Some of the chat room was asking. It wasn't that epic of a Bill Clinton rant. Just compared to everybody else, because nobody else ever rants about Bill Clinton no more. And if they did, it would just be about Whitewater, some crap, because everybody else is stupid except me. So, you know, by the theory of relativity, yes, it was the best Clinton rant ever. But compared to, you know, if you really ask me to prepare and get ready to say every hateful thing I have to say about Bill Clinton, then man, it was like a 1 out of 10. That was nothing compared to how much I hate that bastard. But anyway, yeah, I think, let's see if you go back to, go to scotthorton.org/show, and then I think it was the last segment of the show on the 12th. That's the full show archives there. I believe it was the 12th, but I could be wrong. But I might be right. Okay. Yeah, Bill Clinton. God, I hate that guy. He is a really bad person. Okay. One thing I wanted to elaborate on real quick. You heard this brought up in the Greg Palast interview there a little while ago. And that is about the Koch brothers and Bill Clinton's acquittal in the U.S. Senate. Did you catch that? What was that? Did you say, wait, what? It's in Greg Palast's book, The Best Democracy Money Can Buy. And here's how it happened. Remember Newt Gingrich and the Republican Revolution of 1994? The backlash to the existence of Bill Clinton. So, what happened was the Kochs broke all kind of laws to run those Republican campaigns and make that Republican revolution possible. Remember the contract with America and all that crap? It was the Kochs that paid for that. And the thing of it is that the Justice Department could have nailed them to the wall. Or, you know, various degrees of nail them to the wall. Because the state is still more powerful than any billionaire. And what happened was they made a deal. Trent Lott was the head Republican in the Senate at the time, I believe the majority leader of the Senate at the time, and then his counterpart in the Democrats was Tom Daschle, and they made a deal that, and here's the deal, I love this too, you leave out James Riotti and John Wong, that is Bill Clinton's at least bribery, maybe treason, as long as we're quoting the impeachment articles out of the Constitution here. Bribery, treason, or other high crimes and misdemeanors. You leave John Wong and James Riotti out of your articles of impeachment, and we won't move and indict for all the laws broken in the bankrolling, the Koch's bankrolling of the Republican Revolution, midterm congressional elections of 1994. And so the deal was struck. And so the only articles of impeachment against Bill Clinton were about lying in Paula Jones' deposition, committing perjury. in Paula Jones' deposition, committing perjury before the federal grand jury, and then obstruction of justice, and I forget the fourth charge. But anyway, they completely left out the fact that this guy, Riotti, was the son of the guy who was the half owner of the Lippo Bank of Indonesia, the other half of which was owned by the People's Liberation Army, the government, the military of China, and that they had put Riotti's man, John Wong, in the Commerce Department. Not only was he the guy with the giant sack of money with the dollar sign on it, he was the guy that they put in charge of doing the licensing of the missile technology transfers, the rocket technology transfers to China. They stripped that authority away. Not that I'm into protectionism and everything, but still, this is a scandal. Don't get the principle confused with the laws that were broken. These were, and of course, these are government-funded military-industrial complex firms, Loral and Hughes Aircraft, who were transferring, selling, and helping the Chinese perfect their three-stage intercontinental ballistic missiles for use in putting satellites in orbit, but also for use in delivering hydrogen bombs to your town if it ever came to that. You know, if America ever picked a nuclear war with China. But anyway, so they stripped that authority to license which technology was okay to transfer. It's dual-use technology. It's the kind of thing where if right now, if Obama was doing it for the Iranians, people would be completely flipping out. This would be how to help them, or to North Korea, how to help them deliver their weapons here, in effect. And when you look at the crooked deal that made it all possible, it sure looks about as crooked as could possibly be. And then, they stripped the authority away, from defense and state, and they gave it to the Commerce Department, and they gave it to Riotti's man that they had placed in the Commerce Department, John Wong, to do all the licensing. And, by the way, and this really happened, and I really think this is a thing. Now, it's possible that there's been some journalism done that debunked this that I'm not aware of, but as far as I know, this is really a thing, is that John Wong's secretary was murdered. And they found her after Thanksgiving. She was there at the Commerce Department. I don't know if her family had been looking for her or what, but security came and unlocked the door, went to the Commerce Department. There she was, and had been apparently beaten to death. And as far as I know, that was an unsolved crime, but she was a major witness to this major act of, I would call it treason, but at least Bill Clinton's bribery by a foreign government. To transfer dual-use, rocket technology that could be used for nuclear weapons. And the multiple re-entry vehicle stuff, independent re-entry vehicles. And the Republicans went ahead and impeached him only for the Lewinsky crap, which was boiled down in the media to he's in trouble for cheating on his wife, as though that was the damn charge, that he had had sexual relations that had not been, appropriated by the House of Representatives. When, of course, the charge was committing perjury in front of a federal grand jury, which Bill Clinton would have seen you locked under the prison for daring. But whatever, don't worry about that. Different laws apply to him than you. You don't have to worry. And anyway, so the Republicans, if they had impeach him. And I remember Bob Barr, and I'm not the biggest Bob Barr fan, but I remember Bob Barr on talk radio in 1998 saying, listen, I wanted to include the John Wong, James Riotti stuff in the articles of impeachment. But the leadership just won't let it happen, and I don't understand why. And the host of the show saying, yeah, come on, Bob, why not? And he's going, I really don't know. But he seemed, and he wasn't like hinting and being cute and coy either, but he seemed to think that there was a reason why not. He just didn't know what it was. And Greg Palast broke that story. That's what it was. The Koch brothers. They had broken the law in bankrolling the Republican Revolution in 1994. And in order to protect them and protect themselves, the Republicans decided. I mean, think about this. This is the same thing with any president. This is why Nixon was the only one who ever actually would have been removed from office. Lincoln's Johnson was impeached but spared removal by one vote in the Senate. That was the only time there was a real impeachment, and it wasn't even about a crime. It was about he fired his cabinet, and the Senate didn't want him to, but they didn't have the right to dictate his cabinet to him, and so shut up. So that was why he was acquitted there. Nixon's the only one who he resigned because he was going to be removed by the Senate. Barry Goldwater told him, "You lied to me, you son of a bitch, you're done. You might as well go home now, pal, and save us. Spare us the trial, because you're going to lose it." So that was once. The rest of the time, these guys, they do whatever they want. And of course, Nixon, he wasn't impeached for murdering a million Laotians and Cambodians without congressional authorization, which would have made it perfectly fine. No, it was just for covering up a third-rate burglary and all of that, right? Anyway, so, little footnote, just so you know, Greg Palast, Best Democracy Money Can Buy is the source. Trent Lott and Tom Daschle's crooked deal to save Bill Clinton's presidency. No, never did like that guy very much, no. By the way, here's the thing real quick I'll say. It's all the news on the internet and on CNN and everything that the pot experiment in Colorado is going swimmingly. From the point of view of the state, the only point of view that matters. And the state's point of view is, damn, they're making a lot of money. And wow, it turns out there's a lot of demand for pot. Isn't it funny that all of those very same people demanding pot and, you know, entering into voluntary exchange for it in order that they might have some in Colorado, were all criminals just month before last. Does that sound right to you? Were they bad guys? Were they muggers or armed robbers or telephone scammers who prey on old ladies? No, they're just pot smokers, that's all. Never did nothing to you. It never was any of your business in the first place. And now we see that, hey, wow, apparently a significant percentage of the population of Colorado likes smoking pot. And it never was any of anyone else's damned business. But anyway. So now they're all buying pot, and they're buying so much of it that the state is making a killing off of the taxes. And that's the part that bothers me. I would like to encourage the people of Colorado to forget all that. Jeez, man, if there's one silver lining to all the underground black markets in weed distribution that have been created in Colorado over the eons, it's that you don't have to pay a bunch of taxes for it. So right now, you're not going to get busted if you have pot in your pocket, right? So it doesn't matter if you're just getting it from your guy. So why don't you keep getting it from your guy and stop paying money to the government? On TV, they're talking about the cops are going to get millions of these dollars. Oh, great. So now the pot smokers are subsidizing the oppression of other people. Oh, well, you're doing a drug that you were prescribed, but you're past your expiration date. That makes you a criminal. And now the pot smokers are having to fund that? That's not right. I say boycott the white market in Colorado and keep buying your pot from the underground. Still legal anyway, right? And grow your own, for Christ's sake, man. Throw some seeds in the yard, Coloradoans. Don't pay more taxes, extra taxes. That was one of the main reasons I quit smoking cigarettes. I was telling myself, self, you are paying extra taxes. Without all the taxes, this pack of cigarettes would still be $2.50. This is all taxes, money that the government is going to spend murdering people. So, yeah. Oh, yeah. I spaced out and forgot. Got to play commercials for you.
So, you're a libertarian, and you don't believe the propaganda about government awesomeness you were subjected to in fourth grade. You want real history and economics. Well, learn in your car from professors you can trust with Tom Woods' Liberty Classroom. And if you join through the Liberty Classroom link at scotthorton.org, we'll make a donation to support the Scott Horton Show. Liberty Classroom, the history and economics they didn't teach you.
All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton, and this is my show. You know, I meant to follow up question. I think I messed up and forgot to follow up my follow-up with Phil Giraldi the other day when he sort of said, well, I don't know, America's really backing ISIS and al-Nusra and all that. But the thing of it is, yeah, they are, man, because the thing of it is, well, Phil's the guy who broke the story back in December. It would have been December the 7th or December the 8th. I think it was December the 7th. Nah, because that would have been Pearl Harbor Day, and I would have remembered that. So it was December the 8th, 2011. That Phil Giraldi wrote an article at antiwar.com called, did I say 2011? I meant to. Where it was called Washington's Secret Wars. And it was Phil Giraldi, former CIA officer, saying, listen, I got word from other CIA officers, and they're telling me that Obama has signed two new findings, one on Syria and one on Iran, cranking up covert action. That was at the end of 2011. And you know what? There was already some something going on there. I don't know if he had had just Special Forces or some other nameless agency or what screwing around already, because that was still the end of 2011, and Syria action had been going on for quite a few months by then. But anyway, that was... and then actually Eric Margulies, our previous guest, was reporting about European Special Forces and American, I think, and American Special Forces, certainly French Special Forces on the ground in Syria helping the rebels. And then came all the reports about Prince Bandar and the Saudis raising up a Mujahideen army and sending them off to Syria to fight. And then, of course, you know, the Sunni areas of Iraq have been basically lawless Sunni tribal-held territory with still, I guess, some pretty significant numbers of al-Qaeda and Iraq veterans from Abu Musab al-Zarqawi's old group, who had called themselves the Islamic State of Iraq since, I guess, after he died in 2006 or so. And they started moving into Syria. And it's funny the way, I ought to get David Enders and maybe a couple others too and have them all talk about it and try to come up with this discrepancy for me. The current scam is that the Nusra Front, which is a name you might remember for being synonymous with al-Qaeda over the last couple of years, that's now just the Islamic Front, and they're the moderates. But they're really just talking about al-Nusra, I think. I'm pretty certain that's all they mean by that. Because the so-called moderates, all they ever had was the Al-Farouk Brigade of cannibals and the Northern Storm Brigade of Iraq War veterans, John McCain's friend, and this guy Idris, who was just a big fat expat on the dole. He wasn't a real warrior, a leader of any people fighting in the rebellion there at all, or whatever you call it, the war there at all. All they were doing is just running the warehouse and collecting the graft, you know? And they tried two or three different sock puppet, you know, rebel councils or whatever. All of them, you know, Hillary Clinton created things. And each time they did, you know, like when they'd have a meeting in Doha, Qatar, they would immediately turn right around and endorse the al-Nusra Front and the al-Qaeda guys, because they're the only legitimate opposition to the Ba'athist regime on the ground there to fight. They don't have any legitimacy whatsoever as a bunch of big fat expats on the dole. The closest thing they can come to legitimacy is claiming that they support the guys who are out there actually doing the fighting. So, and these are the ones who were set up by the Americans and the Europeans in the first place. And then at this point, now this happened at the very end of December, the Free Syrian Army was run right out of town, such as it was, their warehouses seized. Now their commander, Idris, has been completely fired and banished from Syria. I don't know if he's probably, you know, in Paris or in D.C. right now. He's not leading a damn thing in Syria. And in the last 2.5-3 years, really over the last, I guess, year and a half, we've seen the rise of the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria. You know, they call it different things, but basically this ISIS group, Iraq and the Sham or whatever. Anyway, point being that they're saying, well, Nusra is not al-Qaeda in Iraq come to Syria. Al-Nusra, which they had been reporting, sorry, I meant to say that earlier, and that was part of my thing here, was that the al-Nusra guys from the get-go, they really were the veterans of the Iraq War. But most of them Iraqi, I had thought, by then. But no. At least according to the narrative now, the al-Nusra Front, they're like al-Qaeda in all of their goals. They want a radical Sunni Islamist state. There are no Muslim Brotherhood, you know, rich old guys, you know, old kind of right-wing religious Republicans. They're kind of the radical right. And poor metaphor, but not that poor. And, you know, they're revolutionaries, not conservatives, is all I'm trying to say. And, but I guess the way they break it down now, they say the al-Nusra Front are more Syrian nationalist, well, at least from there. And ISIS are really the Iraqis and the meanest of the Iraqis. And now they have this multi-front war going on. And this is one of the things I was going to say to Eric and I forgot. I should have wrote it down, man. But he was saying something smart, so I started listening instead of thinking what I wanted. And that was about, oh, don't tell me I forgot it now. That was about, reporting out of Syria about how many times over the rebels have lost in Homs and in Aleppo, and the hopelessness of the rebels from all the intergroup warfare among the rebels, where, you know, there's all kind of reporting out of there. I wish I had a bunch of footnotes for you. Foreign Policy Magazine or foreignpolicy.com had some stuff, and there's some other stuff where people are saying, this is ridiculous. These are people who were you know, rebels from the get-go back in 2011, who are saying, man, you know, all is lost now. There's no war against the regime. It's just a war of all against all now. I mean, I guess the regime against all, but all the other factions against each other. And from their point of view, the whole thing is completely hopeless. The whole war is already lost. Now it's a matter of just protecting themselves from the jihadis who they invited to come and help them fight, and who may end up staying where they are. Unless America and you know, completely backs down and makes the Saudis completely back down in supporting these guys, which the Americans, I think, probably could force the Saudis to do if they really made them stop. And then we'd have to just sit back and watch as the Russians armed up the Ba'athists and let the Ba'athists do their best to crush this Islamist insurgency. Just the way America is right now, with the help of the Iranians, arming up the Shiite government, the Shiite dictatorship in Iraq, in Baghdad, to fight against the Islamist Sunni insurgency there. Instead, America's fighting the Mujahideen, helping Maliki fight the Mujahideen in Syria, in Iraq, while denouncing him for helping the Iranians funnel weapons to the Shiite dictatorship in Syria to fight that exact same war. These Democrats are just, I don't know, man. I shouldn't have said, aren't they stupid, and don't you agree with that? I should have asked him, Eric Margulies, in a less leading the witness kind of a way. What the hell are they doing in Syria, man? You know, again, with the remote view and the conversation in the Oval Office, somebody's got to point out, they've got to have an understanding. It's not like they don't understand who's backing who and who's on whose side of what over there. Makes no sense. And especially when they're trying right now to resolve the single outstanding issue, as bogus as it is, but it is the single deal-breaking outstanding issue of all between America and Iran, and that's their civilian nuclear electricity program. And they're now trying to negotiate it to such a degree that they have so many additional protocols to their safeguards agreement that, fine, America will finally shut up about it and lift the sanctions. So if that's what Obama's trying to do, go ahead and make friends with the Iranians in that sense. Why does he gotta work so hard, even to the point of backing al-Qaeda by the tens of thousands of these guys in Syria right now in order to weaken Iran's friends, the Syrians? America doesn't have anything else against the Syrian government other than that they're friends with the Iranians. Is it that you have two different departments at the State Department where the people don't like talking to each other? Or their Kerry's people can't get along with the National Security Council? What is the split on the policy here? It's stupid. It makes no sense whatsoever. I don't know, man. Maybe it is just stupid. I mean, we are talking about the Democrats. You heard Palast. Palast was like, man, John Kerry's got a hell bent for Venezuela over tomatoes. Tomatoes. Oh, man, and I don't doubt it either, man. The tomato industrial complex is a powerful force in America. Don't think for a minute they're not. Any corporation that can buy a senator will buy a senator. And any senator has to start a war or do whatever he has to do in order to satisfy whatever business can buy him for a low, low price once. He'll do it. He'll do anything. Why? Because it ain't his money and it ain't his son. Simple as that. And John Kerry, he's actually married to the Hines lady. Oh, Christ. You Venezuelans might as well just blow your brains out now. You ain't got a prayer. Them commies seized her ketchup concern. Oh, say it ain't so. Say it ain't so, but it is. That's how it works. It's called fascism. It's a participatory fascism. And I admit that the footage is in high def, high color, not old grainy black and white footage. And they're not speaking Italian or a German, they're speaking English. But that might be what makes it fascism too. Not fascism. Anyway. Well, you know, in junior high they taught me it's a quasi-free market. Oh, I get it. Fascism. Quasi-free market. It's a mixed economy, Scott. You know, gotta tame the excesses of freedom and getting out of control and all that. Don't want those excesses. Right? Thanks, guys, for hearing me out. See you Monday.